Good evening, everyone. How are you all doing tonight? You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and there's a lot of changes going on in our planet. And here on Paradigm Shifters, we like to meet people that are actually helping with creating change, making changes, riding the waves of change. And we have a paradigm shifter tonight called Michael Drew. And Michael represents Promote a Book, meaning he can tell you how to promote and market your own book so that it becomes a bestseller, which is kind of exciting in itself. And Michael is traveling to an event called the Engage Today event in Calgary, Alberta, featuring a number of innovative business people, people who are making changes again on the planet, a load of paradigm shifters. So welcome to the show, Michael Drew.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, I know that you're a mover and groover because you're traveling as we talk, right?
Absolutely. I'm traveling from a meeting up in North Austin down to the Scenic Wizard Academy in southwest Austin.
Well, what's a wizard academy? Is that how to be a wizard?
No, Roy H. Williams was actually my first New York Times best-selling author. The title of his first book was The Wizard of Ads.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And he bought 37 acres of land down in southwest Austin, and he started a 501c3 nonprofit business communication school. He actually bought the land, built a bunch of buildings, and donated it to the nonprofit. One of his literary inspirations, if you will, is Cervantes, the author of Man of La Mancha.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. And he has a free wedding chapel on this 37-acre property called Chapel Dulcinea. It's a beautiful campus. They have a student housing facility. They do at least one workshop a week there at their event location called Tuscan Hall.
And then on how to do ads, how to make ads,
any form of communication. Actually, one of the interesting things that he teaches is how to apply quantum physics and quantum mechanics towards impacting your communication or advertising copy. He also talks about how to apply third gravitating bodies, to part of quantum physics, to impacting and improving the quality of your copy and advertising as well. Roy, of the 57 books I've placed on the New York Times bestsellers list, Roy is the most brilliant person I've ever met in my entire life.
Really?
Absolutely. If you come down to Austin, the Wizard Academy is a staple. It's a gorgeous location. The city, especially West Austin, sits on top of the Edwards Aquifer, and the Edwards Aquifer is beneath about 300 yards of limestone. On top of that limestone sits about, depending on the area, between 3 to 5 feet of dirt. And what Roy did for his parking lot would simply remove the dirt off of the limestone. So he's got this gorgeous 3-acre parking lot of limestone that's naturally there. The student housing facility, Engelbrick House, is on, it has 12 or 15 rooms. It's like any five-star, four-star posh hotel, only that Roy's goal is to take people out of the world and expand their minds. And so at Engelbrick House, there's no TV and there's no telephone. There is internet connection so you can do work, but the idea is to be able to step back into 5th century Spain almost. Again, his literary icon, if you will, is Cervantes. And when you're at the Wizard Academy, it's a true experience. So if anyone has an opportunity to come to Austin, I'd highly recommend that they visit the Wizard Academy in southwest Austin.
That's great. I bet it's got a website, huh?
Wizardacademy.org.
Great. Well, also, you had to do with creating the huge market for the Harvey Ecker's book?
Harvey Ecker's book, Secrets of the Millionaire Mind.
Yeah, now, didn't he set up a whole bunch of workshops and people were really traveling to go to his experience?
Oh, yeah. He spent two years utilizing his book to basically, if you bought a copy of his book, you'd get you get two seats or two tickets to attend his Mill Your Mind intensive workshop, which he sold for $2,000 a seat. But if you bought the book, you got two seats for free. And he was able to fill that event for almost 3 straight years from selling that book.
Wow. But what was the point of his? Was it also quantum consciousness as far as creating millions of dollars?
No, it was a little more simple than that. I would argue that Roy, the purpose of the Wizard Academy is to teach the world's brightest so that they can go out and educate the masses. Harv's goal was to educate the masses about their money blueprint, how they thought and treated money, and how they could improve their their relationship with money, if you will. But Harv had a beautiful beautiful platform and a beautiful marketing campaign going in, and it was a really, really fun campaign to work on.
So that's an example of people selecting their chosen marketplace, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's probably the biggest book that I've worked on. So it certainly was a lot of fun.
Well, so tell us about you, Michael. What got you into doing this? Are you an author? Are you a business mogul? What is your drive here?
Well, I am 30. I just turned 30 in January, and I've been in this industry for 11 years. I was lucky.
You started young, darling.
Well, thank you. I feel like I've been in the industry for about a third of my life. Well, actually, I have, I suppose. I was managing a Burger King when I was 18, and a old girlfriend of mine said I was too smart to manage Burger King. I'm originally from Provo, Utah, and she recommended that I go work at an organization called Executive Excellence out of South Provo. At the time, Executive Excellence was a division of the Covey Leadership Center.
Oh, and Covey.
Absolutely, Stephen Covey. And the editor-in-chief of the magazine was Ken Shelton. He was also, at least what he said to me, was the ghostwriter of Seven Habits. And I worked there for 3 months selling the magazine, and I became the number 3 salesperson within those 3 months.
And hang on a sec, just in case there are people who don't know it, Stephen Covey wrote the seven, you tell them the title so that they know what we're talking about.
Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Right, okay.
And so, Ken Shelton was the ghostwriter on that, or at least that's what he claims. Anyway, so I was the number 3 salesperson there within 3 months of joining. And at that time, Franklin Day Planners and the Covey Leadership Center decided they would merge organizations and form Franklin Covey. Now, for payment, at least according to Ken Shelton, for payment for ghostwriting Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey gave Ken Shelton the Executive Excellence business. And Ken came to me and he said, hey, Mike, we publish all these great business authors in our magazines. Why don't we start publishing their books? And as a young, naive, at this time, 19-year-old, I said, sure, why the heck not? I can do whatever I want. And that's exactly what I did. Now, in all fairness and candor, I failed miserably for the first year.
Oh.
But in failing, I learned a lot about the industry. And I developed some really great relationships with other people in the industry. Now, in the book industry, the New York publishers have sales reps that call on the buyers at the retailers. But there are roughly 35,000 publishers and only 7 buyers at each of the major retailers. So because of that, the buyers at the retailers don't want to be called on by 35,000 different publishers. So what you have in between are what are called distributors. These distributors represent dozens or even hundreds of different small to medium-sized publishers. And Executive Excellence was distributed by a company called National Book Network, or more commonly by their acronym, NBN. Now, the rep for the publisher, her name was Miriam Bass, and she was a bit of an icon in the book industry. She was the first woman who was a buyer at any of the major chains. Now, some of you may recall Crown Books. They were in California and in the South. They about a decade ago went bankrupt, but and out of business. But she was the first woman to be a buyer, and she was the buyer at Crown Books. And then later in her career, she left and joined National Book Network. Now, she also was the representative for a company called Bard Press, B-A-R-D Press. A gentleman by the name of Ray Bard was the owner, and while he was learning at Executive Excellence, and Bard Press was having a huge success with their book, Nuts, Southwest Airlines Crazy Recipe for Success. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge, huge bestseller. And they were looking at expanding their business. And Miriam had developed a relationship with me while I was at Executive Excellence. And Ray was talking with her about expanding. And what she told him was, hey, there's this really young buck out of Provo, Utah, who's got some really talent. I mean, he's young. He's only 19, but I think you should give him a shot. So he interviewed me and decided to hire me. And the first day on the job, Ray said to me, he said, Mike, we publish business authors. And what authors want more than anything else in the world is to be a New York Times bestselling author. What I want you to do is go figure out how the bestsellers lists work. And as a young, naive 19-year-old, I said, sure, why the heck not? I can do whatever I want. And that's exactly what I did.
Were you always like that as a kid? Yeah, I can do whatever I want. A lot of feistiness.
I suppose. I came from a large family. I was the oldest of 8 kids. And if I wanted anything, I had to go out and get it. So I suppose I've always been this way.
Mm-hmm.
So the first book that I actually placed on the bestsellers list was by Roy H. Williams, the owner, the former owner, I suppose, the chairman of the board for the Wizard Academy here in Southwest Austin. He did a book titled "Secret Formulas of the Wizard of Oz," and we launched it to number 3 on the Wall Street Journal. Number 3 on the New York Times, and number 1 on the Wall Street Journal bestsellers lists.
So what does it take to launch a bestseller? I mean, do you think it's just the time and the trend?
Well, no. See, there's a number of misconceptions about being a bestseller. All being a bestseller means is that your book sells more copies than another book on the list or not on the list. And what makes a book sell isn't necessarily that it's of higher literary quality. There were 300,000 books released last year. Of those 300,000 books, I believe the number was 162 or 163 unique titles made it onto the bestsellers list.
Oh.
What makes a book a bestseller is the author's ability to market that book. With so much competition, not only within the book industry, but so much competition for mind space, when a book is released, it's not just competing with another book. It's competing with family and work and friends and travel and TV and politics and the internet and, kids. It competes with everything. It's not just competing with other books. And people are finding it more and more difficult to actually sit down and spend the hours that it takes to read a book. And so we're actually seeing it right now a little bit of a decrease in the number of books sold every year because of this. But anyway, a book that sells well usually is a book that's written at a fifth grade reading level that's easy for people to digest. And if it's a fiction book, it's got a simple and fun plot line, and if it's a nonfiction title, it's usually making one major point. Something very simple for people to digest.
Wow, I mean, that's sort of hard to, that sounds kind of like a lower end book system, doesn't it?
Well, it in some ways it is. It has to appeal to the masses. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you consider that the average IQ is 100, and the mean is 85. Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at creating something that appeals to a mass market, what makes the bestsellers lists is not necessarily what's of highest literary quality.
Right. It's like all art is like that in a way. So, so what are the steps that you take to create the bestseller?
Well, basically, one of the things you have to understand is that none of the bestsellers lists are actually real bestsellers lists. And when I say that, they are bestsellers lists, but none of them are counting real sales in real time.
Hmm.
Every retailer has their own system or criteria for counting for reporting sales that are sold at their retailer. Not every book that is reported to the bestseller, not every book that is sold at a retailer is reported to the bestsellers list. And in turn, not every book that is reported to the bestsellers list is counted, or if it is counted, it's not necessarily going to be counted equally.
Mm.
So the first issue is recognizing the reality in the sellers list, reality that it's not a complete, it's not, I shouldn't say that it's not real. It's not a complete system.
Okay.
It's got its own idiosyncrasies and issues and problems with it. Once you recognize that, and then you have to look at the book, first of all, in isolation of the bestsellers list. What is a book? How does it work? How does it sell?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that a book is doing two things. First of all, it's helping the author accomplish his or her goals, number one. And number two, it's meeting some need of the reader. Most books fail because they fail to meet the need of the reader. Most books that are truly successful meet both the author and the reader's needs.
Okay, so tell me this. Do you actually gauge the reader's needs according to the trend through the society?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. The great thing about technology today, especially social media, is that we're able to write a book that we know our audience is going to buy. I actually teach a workshop called Book Publishing 2.0, and at that course, we teach people how to write their book through their blog and use social media to drive traffic to that blog so that they can test to determine who their audience is, number one, and number two, to make sure that not only that their angle of approach is correct for their audience, but they're actually delivering the content in the way that the audience wants the content delivered to them.
Hmm.
See, the great thing about social media and blogging is when you put something out, you're joining a conversation. It's not a one-way conversation like you would get in traditional media or even in traditional book publishing, but rather it's about commenting and commenting back. When you make a blog post, someone oftentimes they're going to make a comment about your blog, and you'll make a comment back, and you start a conversation. The point of blogging and social media is to be a starting point for that conversation.
Well, I just am fascinated by the fact that the books that you mentioned that were bestsellers are actually on a different level like that. The Wizard of Ads represents an interaction place called a center. And the millionaire one is the interaction of the workshop space and so on. So they're not just books anymore, are they?
Right.
Whether they're in a social network or whether they're in a big workshop space or an actual center. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, that's one of the things we teach at Book Publishing 2.0 is that it's never, ever about the book.
Hmm.
The book is simply a tool to assist some people with achieve part of their goal. A book... in most cases, cannot be the end-all be-all. It can only be some things to some people.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is that it is just a tool.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we teach at Book Publishing 2.0 is something called persuasion architecture, which was created by a company that's traded on the NASDAQ out of Brooklyn, New York, called Future Now, Inc. Their website's futurenowinc.com. And basically what we do is we take the demographics of our clients and the psychographics using Myers-Briggs specifically. For those of your listeners that don't know what psychographics are, they're the underlying psychology of people and what motivates them from a psychological standpoint. And Myers-Briggs is a tool for evaluating different personality types and how they function within society. So we use the demographics of Myers-Briggs and psychographics in the creation of what we call personas.
Mm-hmm.
And these personas are the literal personification of who our authors, readers are.
So let's just use some of the terms, which are like judging, thinking, feeling aspects of kind of the way people approach things, right?
Correct. So when we look in Myers-Briggs, they say there are four different personality categories with one of two options each. They say you're either an extrovert or an introvert, and that's an issue of where you derive your energy from. An extrovert derives your energy from outside of yourself. An introvert derives their energy from within inside of themselves. It's, the common misnomer is that it has to do with your ability to deal with people in public. I'm actually an introvert, and I do fine in public. The difference is when I'm in public, I have to push energy out of myself, and it exhausts me, whereas an extrovert, when they're in public, they feed off of the energy of the people that are around them. It actually energizes them. The next category is intuition versus sensing. Someone who uses intuition is able to use their sixth sense, if you will. They see the bigger picture, and they see how things fit together. Someone, they don't need all the details. They can just naturally see how you can go from point A to point B, even if they don't see all of the details in between. Mm-hmm. A sensing type, they have to see everything. They have to touch, taste, smell, hear, feel something to know that it's true. They have to use their senses to know that it's true. The next category is feeling versus thinking. Someone who's a feeler, they use their emotions in making decisions. And someone who is a thinker, they use logic and information to make their decisions. And the final category is perceiving versus judging. A perceiver sees things in terms of gray. They see things in terms of opportunity. Someone who's a judging type, they look at things in terms of black and white. They look at it in terms of absolutes. And so you've got those four quadrants, but in Myers-Briggs, there's basically four combinations of those. You can come up with 16 personality types with variations on those four category, or four areas, the two options each. We actually break it down into four quadrants. The NT, the intuitive thinker, the NT in this case dominate the other two categories of extrovert, introvert, or judging versus perceiving. The NT is what we call competitives at Publishing 2.0. The NF, the intuitive feeler, is what we call a humanist. The SJ, the sensing judging type, because they have to sense, touch, taste, smell, see things, hear things, and know that they're true. Also because they're a judging type. They see things in terms of black and white. They see things in terms of processes and systems. We call them methodicals. They're your accountants, your engineers. And then there's your SP, your sensing perceiving type. Again, like the SJ, they have to taste, touch, smell, see things to know that they're real. But unlike the methodical, they see things in terms of opportunity. They see things in terms of gray. Most artists and musicians are SPs. We call them spontaneous. About 60% of all salespeople are also spontaneous because they live in a moment. They live based on the energy right now. How do they feel right this very moment? And they go from one feeling to the next. So a spontaneous would make a natural salesperson because they go from the high of one sale to the if that makes sense.
It does. So I'm thinking of how do you apply this to the market then? You gauge whether...
So here's the great thing. When you're writing a book, if we assume that, to start off with, because if someone's a first-time author and they haven't done market research on their audience, they don't know on a human level who their audience is, we can make some basic assumptions about their demographics, but then we can take those four quadrants, the spontaneous, the methodical, the humanist, and the competitive, and we can say, all right, we're going to create one persona and character for each of those personality types. What we're going to do is we're going to come up with a range of a spectrum of demographics, and we're going to start applying those demographics into these personas. So we'll take a competitive person. Well, so this person is going to be an NT competitive. Now we're going to say that it's a woman that's 35. She went to Harvard. She wants to be a lawyer. I don't know what the book is. I'm just making this up. But we start applying the demographics to the psychographics. And at the end of it, we've colored who this person is. We know about their psychology. We know about where they're from. We know if they're married. We know what their likes, dislikes are. We then create a narrative about their background, where they are and where they're going and why they're interested in this book. We give them a name and a photo, and we start talking about them like real people.
And you email.
And so we start having these four personas. And what we do is we have our students write a blog post for every topic in their book to each of the four personas.
Oh, wow.
Because the idea here is, again, blogging is about joining the conversation. And if we're talking to a person, that we can think of in our minds that we've written out, competitive or humanist or spontaneous, the angle of approach on any topic is going to be completely different for each of those four personalities. You're going to talk about the same thing, not be repetitive, because you're talking, because the angle of approach is very, very different.
That's the kind of language you use and so on. Well, let me ask you this. Is the nature of the creating bestsellers and actually this, what did you call it, the psychodemographic?
Persuasion architecture.
Yeah, okay. Is that part of, let's go into the next thing, which is called the pendulum. What did you call it? There's a pendulum movement, 40-year cycles in and amongst people. And I have some theories also that there's there are shifts going on that are, if there's a pendulum, the pendulum is on a spiral. There's kind of incremental vibrational shifts and consciousness shifts. So you're talking about 40-year pendulum. So I wanted you to refer to that, and then I'll...
Certainly. Well,
Then I'll confuse the issue.
No, that's fine. I'm happy to address that. So let's set up the context. And just to let everyone know, I'm going to be doing the pendulum presentation in Calgary, Alberta, on the 30th of September or 1st of October at an event called Engage Today. It's a really great event, and if they go to Engage Today, event.com. They sign up. In fact, we actually have a really great promotion for the event going on. Greg Hasbrit, the founder of and the person putting this event on, came to my book publishing 2.0 course and just loved it. Now, speaking at the event, we've got the Dalai Lama, we've got Sir Richard Branson, we have Stephen Covey, we have Janet Atwood. I'm speaking. We have a number of other really great speakers that are speaking at this event. But Greg came to the event, Book Publishing 2.0. He loved it, and he decided to give a scholarship to any attendee of Engage Today to Book Publishing 2.0 for our October event, which we're doing in Edmonton, or our Salt Lake City event, which we're doing in November. So going to Book Publishing 2.0 normally costs $2,000. Going to Engage Today costs $2,000. So kind of what if you sign up today, basically what you're getting is a two-for-one. You're able to attend both Engage Today with all of the top thought leaders in the world, as well as being able to attend Book Publishing 2.0 at no additional cost.
Well, that sounds good, but I want to know what Engage Today is about. Is it mostly about business and trends, new business? Great, is that what it's about? Or?
Well, there's both a personal and business side of things. Engage Today is actually about getting people to take action today, and this actually goes back to the conversation about being in the civic cycle. And so I'll bring this back around once we're done setting the context for the pendulum. There was a book published in 1991 by Strauss and Howe. They're formerly MIT professors and sociologists. And what they did is they went back and researched Western civilization for the last 400 years. And what they were able to determine was that society actually shifts every 40 years between an idealistic or individualistic mindset to a civic mindset. Now, an individualistic or idealistic mindset is about the individual. It's about big dreams. It's about looking and feeling good today. In a civic cycle, it is no longer about the individual. It is about community. It's not about big dreams. It's about small actions. It's about going out and taking action. And they were able to prove over the last 400 years that, like clockwork, these systems occurred over and over again. Now, I mentioned Roy Williams earlier. Roy actually was the original creator of this pendulum presentation. And when he read this book for the first time, titled Generations, he was like, well, this is really great. But Roy is a strong evangelical Christian, and he also noted that in the Old Testament, there are more than 160 mentions of 40-year generational patterns. As an example, Moses was 40 years old when he was kicked out of Egypt. And he was kicked out of Egypt because he was a strong individualist. He did what he wanted. an Egyptian slave master killed a Hebrew slave. He got upset and he killed the Egyptian slave master. When he came back 40 years later, he had changed completely. He was not the same person. He was humbled. He was slow of speech. He actually couldn't speak for himself. He had to have his half-brother, Aaron, speak for him. And he came back to do what?
I don't know.
When he came back to Egypt, he came back to free the people.
Hmm.
He left as a strong individualist, and he came back as a community organizer. Hmm. And when the Israelites wandered around the wilderness for worshiping a golden calf, to allow a generation to die off, they had to wander around the wilderness for 40 years. Again, in the Old Testament, they only went back to through 400 years of modern civilization. But in the Old Testament, there were more than 160 mentions of 40-year generational patterns. And so, it seems pretty clear to me that this is a pattern that is consistent within mankind.
Well, let's look at the current times. Let's look at the last 40 years and so on. You said we're into a 40-year switch now. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. The last 40 years, if you look at the beginning of this last cycle, the idealist cycle was in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what happened in the 60s, it was all about being free and doing your own thing and going out and being strong and individual, and it was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all of these things. It was about peace and love and harmony.
It was about dismantling unfair systems too.
And it was certainly about that, because in an idealist cycle, an idealist generation rejects conformity and it rejects systems, anything that puts constraints on the individual. The focus becomes the individual. You think back to the 60s or the music of the 70s or what people refer to as the plastic 80s. As you go into a cycle, the core concepts of that become perverted and they become extreme. At the height of an idealistic cycle, we become a society that is plastic, that is phony. We become a society of opposers, essentially. And at that point, the youth of society rejects that mentality and starts to pull it back down the other way. And by the end of the 40-year cycle, the youth of society in music and literature and technology have already been creating for between 5 and 10 years what's going to become the new modality, the new mentality. So by 1983, we'd got into a level of perversion within this idealistic mindset. And the youth of society, I mean, you think back to the 80s, you've got your rockers with the long hair, I think they call it cock rock, and you had Kiss, and you had all these over-the-top stage shows. You look at the politics, the 80s, you look at the problems on Wall Street in the 80s, the whole thing lends itself to this idealistic mentality. Well, as of 1993, we start to see the emergence of the internet with AOL. We start to see a change in our music in 91 with gangster rap and with the grunge movement from the Northwest, where we start to talk about reality, what's real. Be real. Yeah, we start saying things like "be real, man." But, you know, in all that, dog, in all that, where it's all about authenticity and transparency. The currencies in a civic cycle are authenticity and transparency.
Hmm.
In 1958, society was too racist to allow a black man to be the purveyor of our next type of music. Chuck Berry really was the innovator of rock and roll. But we had to find a white man to sing a black man's music, so we had to find Elvis Presley to popularize rock and roll. And even as recently as 11 years ago, society was still too racist to allow a black man to be the new purveyor of our next type of music, and so we had to find another white guy to sing a black man's music. And again, right on cue, 40 years after after Elvis Presley, we have Eminem as the number one artist in 1998. And what did he sing about? What it was like growing up in the ghetto of Detroit.
Hmm.
In 2001, we see Survivor, and we see the birth of To Your Fire. We see the birth of reality TV. You see, in a civic cycle, it's all about reality. It's about, again, our currencies are authenticity and transparency, and it's not about the individual. It's about the community. Let's look at this last election cycle. We had a maverick. We had a strong individualist and feminist. And we had a community organizer.
I see what you're saying.
In a civic cycle, who do you think is going to win? The maverick who belongs in the idealist cycle?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Or the strong individualist feminist or this community organizer.
And we've also had an awful lot of illumination of corrupt systems over the last while as well.
Well, and that's the other thing. It's interesting. If you look back at the last civic cycle, 8 years into the cycle, or 7 years, six years into the cycle, we get into the Great Depression. What happens in an idealist cycle, the longer we go into it, the more we start buying into our own crap. We start believing we're bigger and better than we are, and that we can do more and be more than what we actually can do. This is true of us as individuals in society, and this translates in with business. And what happens is when we move from this idealistic mindset, where it's about being bigger than we are, into a civic mindset where we're demanding authenticity and transparency, when we actually look at the crap that we created, the inflation that was created, suddenly we say, oh, this isn't actually real. And so we see a depression or a recession occur. It happened 80 years before that as well. It happened right before the Civil War as well. It happened 80 years before that. It happens over and over and over again in our economy. If you go back, there's a book by Harry Dent Jr. that actually talks about a Great Depression or a huge recession every 80 years, basically because of this exact reason. So these are patterns or systems that happen over and over and over again. And we've now moved into this, as of 2003, we've moved into a civic cycle where it's no longer about the individual, it's about the community. It's not about big dreams like it is in an idealist cycle, it's about taking small actions. So that's where Engage Today comes in, because Engage Today is all about taking small actions, both in your personal life, in your civic life, and in your business life. The speakers that they're bringing in, from the Dalai Lama, who's going to be talking about personal things and spirituality, to Sir Richard Branson, who's going to be talking about civic-mindedness, to Stephen Covey, who's going to be talking about in terms of business, to myself. We're all trying to get society to take action. This is what's necessary in a civic cycle. It's no longer enough to dream. We actually have to go out and engage today.
But, Michael, when you're talking about taking small actions, you're talking about many people taking them with the kind of comprehension of one another doing it, the understanding that there's a bunch of you doing it, not just one, right? It's not about heroics.
No, it's not about heroics, but it certainly can be an individual knowing full well that they're the only one doing the right thing. One of the reasons that people either go along with the crowd or don't do the right thing is because they're the only ones doing it, and they're afraid to do it. I'm saying that as a culture, individually and as a whole, we should all be going out and engaging and doing the right thing, and doing the right thing for the right thing's sake. There will be a point in probably 20 years from now where we lose our identity and we become too regimented and too conformed. But right now we have a real opportunity to seize on the visions and dreams of the last idealist cycle and to put into action those dreams. Again, in either cycle, either in the idealistic or the civic cycle, about 20, 25 years in, it becomes too much. But the best time to really see change in society are the 10 years when you're entering into a new society. Those are the years when people still have the old, they remember the old ways, but they're now starting to take action, and that's where we're at. There were some really great ideas and beliefs and visions from the last idealist cycle. Now is the time to actually enact those things and make them happen.
Well, let me ask you this. Does that mean that, say, for example, the bestsellers that you've really helped to get going are actually reflective of these new cycles since 2003? You see what I'm saying? Is like the literature and all of that, like waves of awareness that's flowing out over all of us?
Well, yeah, the thing is, we can all feel and see that there are changes going on.
Mm-hmm.
They're all around us, and we're all aware that they are. The biggest issue for most people is that they can't make the connection as to why they're occurring. Mm-hmm. Where have we come from, and where are we going, and what's and why? What I'm doing with the pendulum presentation is actually connecting those dots for people so that they can actually see, oh, I felt this. I saw these individual pieces. I just never made the connection. Now that I know this, I'm empowered to go out and engage the world.
That's really exciting, actually. So that's what Engage Today is all about.
Absolutely.
And the Dalai Lama is there. I mean, what's he going to do? Is he going to talk?
Yeah, absolutely. He's going to be a presenter there. He's going to be a keynote.
Well, it's interesting because he's actually done an awful lot to go around and seed consciousness all over the world, sort of getting small people to think bigger and to be more self-centered, self-possessed, and kinder, right?
Absolutely. Well, I think he's really seeded, over the last idealist cycle, he's really seeded the mindset to be in a position where I think he'll actually start getting some really good leverage and action out of people now that we're entering into the civic mindset.
Hmm. Where do you see where do you see it all going? You think we're just going to sort of flow in? If it started in 2003 and the first 10 years is really significant, we're coming up to that almost, aren't we?
Well, we're almost fully 7 years in.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have another 3 years. We've certainly entered a tough geopolitical and economic situation, and I think what we do today is going to not only impact this generation, but the next two generations. We're still, there are things that are impacting us today from the Great Depression, so and from the 30s and 40s. So I think it's really important that we are conscious and aware of what's going on around us, what the forces at work are, and how we play a role and how we interact within that.
I'm often fascinated lately that the Internet has given us a global community, an instantaneous global community that's made our thoughts beyond
Isn't that interesting that as we enter into a civic cycle where it's all about community, mm-hmm. that the big buzzword and the big thing that's going on online right now is social media.
Mm-hmm. Network.
Social media, where it's about joining the conversation. Guruship is dead, and leadership requires having a two-way conversation. The reason why book sales are down, the reason why newspapers are down in revenue, is because that's one-way communication. One of the reasons, again, at Book Publishing 2.0, we teach how to write your book through your blog is that people want that two-way conversation. They want to be heard as much as they want to read, mm-hmm. as much as they want to be led.
And my understanding as we spiral up and consciousness moves is that interchange is really helping to spin global consciousness to a higher level.
Yeah, well, again, I think that there are pros and cons to both the idealistic and civic cycles. Again, 20, 25 years from now, we're going to be really conformed and really regimented. That's why in the 60s, the youth were just breaking away from the system because it was so conformed and so regimented, they wanted to do their own thing. But at the end of the idealist cycle, we're all talk and no walk. We're all hype and we're not actually taking the action. And so we're in a really unique time right now where we have the greatest opportunity to make changes. We can capitalize on the dreams and beliefs of the idealist cycle, and we could take the actions to make sure that they happen.
Wow, it's very exciting times, isn't it?
Absolutely, no question.
Okay, so give us some websites and some ways of being in touch, and tell us again about Engage Today event before we sign off, because this has been, you've just got me going thinking, and we need to know how to find you.
What, again, the website is engagetodayevent.com, engagetodayevent.com. And we'll be giving the sign up and scholarships for Book Publishing 2.0 at Engage Today event in Calgary. And that's next Wednesday through Saturday in Calgary, Alberta. Highly recommend that you go. Again, going to that event is will get you a free scholarship to Book Publishing 2.0. Again, it's not just me that's speaking. We've got some of the top thought leaders in the entire world. We've got the Dalai Lama. We've got Sir Richard Branson. We have Stephen Covey. We have Janet Atwood. We have Brandon Burchard. We have a number of the top thought leaders in the entire world.
What do you think, top thought leaders, eh? How we think, how we're learning, right?
Absolutely. And not just from a business standpoint. This is for our personal and spiritual and civic and business lives. So I would highly recommend that anyone who's listening to this this evening or in the future, that between now and next Wednesday, that they go and attend the event. And if you're hearing this after next week, Engage Today will be making the entire event available on CD. So highly recommend that you go ahead and sign up and attend the event, or get the audio program after the event.
Well, that's really exciting. Now, give your website. You've got promoteabook.com. Is that right?
Yeah, promoteabook.com, promoteabook.com. We've got Beneath the Cover, which is my book industry news site. If you want to know about the book industry, how books are published from some of the top experts in the world, Beneath the Cover, BeneathTheCover.com. BeneathTheCover.com.
And do you have advice for people who want to write books? I mean, it's like, yeah, this is a whole different genre in a way, isn't it?
Well, the answer is yes, because if you want to write a book, then you need to understand the context for why you're writing that book and why it's going to sell. The reality is that if you want to write a book, you need to understand that the book is not a reason of profit center. You're not going to make money from that book, from the sale of the book, but you can make money from what the book is going to for your business, or for your what I call your marketing platform, or
so
for
the
your
book is a portal kind of thing.
Exactly. It's what we call in persuasion architecture a driving point.
Hmm. Excellent. Well, I guess I'm going to have to say goodbye, and you're not quite at your landing strip yet, but you're getting there, right?
Absolutely.
I've enjoyed talking to you, Michael, and you've given us a lot to think about. My head's spinning, so I really appreciate this time. Thank you.
It's my absolute pleasure.
All right. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks so much.
All right. So that was interesting. That was a whirlwind of thought and reflections of a new way of seeing, for me anyway, seeing how books, internet, communications go together, and how the market is driven in certain ways of reflecting the changes. I liked what he talked about with the 40-year pendulums. I'm going to think about that for a while. And this is Veronica Entwistle. I'm an intuitive and energy counselor. If you want, this is a little stretch for me doing this particular subject tonight, but it is about consciousness in our species. And if you'd like a session with me, a healing session, or if you want to comment on Michael's interview tonight, or any other suggestions you have for interviewees, email me, Veronica, at veronicaentwistle.com. That's Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com. Thursday night, I'm going to be on Radiance by Design. It's a call-in show all about you at 7 o'clock West Coast time. And this week, what we're going to be talking about is clearing attachments to the past and really getting with the changing frequencies of our time and doing some meditations and so on. And then I'm happy to say I'll be on at 8 o'clock with Jackie Salvitti and the team on ET Healing and Explorations in Consciousness. It's a wonderful show. I'm very honored to be able to be Jackie's support sidekick and talk with the team for you. Now, next week on Paradigm Shifters at 8 o'clock next Tuesday, tune in for Peter Matisse, and he's got the Conscious Business Institute. We have a pre-record, but for the last 15 minutes of the show, we're going to be taking, we're going to be having some interactions with Peter, so feel free to email me your questions on Conscious Business, or you might even do some call-ins at that point. Again, this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening, and blessings to all of you. We'll see you on Thursday here on BBS Radio. Good night.